Amazon, by the way, also, I think, mistakenly benefits from the consumer perception that because it's disintermediated, it's therefore cheaper. Actually, Walmart is a much more efficient distributor of goods than Amazon is, because the last mile delivery to the home is insanely expensive.
Yeah, are you talking about the pickup?
If you think about Walmart, someone drives to Walmart, they buy 57 things, they put them in their truck, and they drive home.
Yeah.
Okay? Now, that's an incredibly efficient form of distribution. Because people at their own expense collect them from, how many branches of Walmart are there in the US? My guess is 4,000. Is that about right, or is it more?
How many Walmarts there are?
How many Walmarts? Yeah, interesting question.
I don't know, because, I mean, you know, it would feel like the kind of thing that's closer to 10,000. But there's, I don't know if you've looked at the way Walmart does business is they'll open in a county where they'll get enormous tax breaks. Those tax breaks will then become invalid, and they'll literally move 5 miles to the right to get more tax breaks from the next county. So,
and close. What happens to the original Walmart store then?
It gets closed.
It's a shell.
Yeah, there's no thought at all to the people who used to work there or any of that sort of thing. And you don't just move all the people over there. It's a source of great annoyance to large numbers of people.
Ah, interesting. Very interesting, by the way, you living in LA, you must notice this utterly weird thing that the US has yet to perfect mid-market grocery retail, which is you can either go to Bristol Farms, which you probably do you?
Yeah, there's one nearby.
Or, for example, Whole Foods, where the things are brilliant but batshit expensive.
Yeah.
Or you buy on price. There doesn't seem to be the American concept of kind of the happy medium in terms of, someone moved from LA to London, and charmingly they said, "We are really impressed with Waitrose. Wonderful quality food," they said, not unfair, reasonable, "and such reasonable prices."
Yeah.
No one in Britain would say Waitrose is such reasonable prices. We'd view it as being not M&S, but at the expensive range, you know, end of the range. But American grocery retailing seems to be completely bipolar.
Well, it's more than bipolar. I don't know what the prefix for nine things is, but what happens is most middle class people who aren't ridiculously rich shop at a place called Trader Joe's. Do you know Trader Joe's?
Now that is, yeah, now I know the front of it's owned by Aldi, I think.
It is, but no one knows that over here.
And actually, Trader Joe's is actually reasonably priced. That is the middle market, I guess.
It is, and what Trader Joe's does that's quite unusual is they sell a quite small number of goods. Like when you go into Ralph's, you've got 10,000 things. When you go into Trader Joe's, it's the basics that you will need 99% of the time, but not Harissa paste, blah, 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 that's really unusual.
Got it, yeah.
So, and they're in places where you can just quickly pop in and get stuff, because obviously LA is very car-based, blah, blah, blah. So Trader Joe's covers a lot of things. Bristol Farms is a bit more... is it a bit more expensive? So is Whole Foods. I have because of the ethical thing, I never shop at Whole Foods because it's now owned by Amazon. And in fact, I never shop on Amazon for the same reason. And all the things we're talking about that are problematic about Amazon, for me, it's really just because they don't pay any tax. They treat their workers terribly. They crush retail sectors, etc. So I don't want to be part of that as a thing.
By the way, why do they do, if you contrast that, okay, with the working practices, say, created by Lord Leverhulme or the early Quakers, okay? The early British industrialists, not always successfully, but were keen to prove that what they offered benefited customers and workers alike, okay? Now, if you look at Amazon, labor costs in Amazon must be a bit of a rounding error, to be absolutely honest.
Yeah.
There's something particularly weird about this mentality that... consumers care about price to a point where Amazon generally scores quite well because the prices are pretty good. Genuinely, why Amazon doesn't put the prices up by a couple of percentage points in return for treating its employees generously, not even fairly, but generously, seems to me very strange, because the one thing that's an existential threat to Amazon is a mass consumer boycott, okay? And which would have, by the way, not only short-term but long-term effects, because people would develop other habits while they boycotted Amazon.
Yeah.
Right? They'd suddenly find they had an account with, you know, I don't know, Tom Lewis or Selfridges or whatever in the US. And there are alternatives. Of course, there's Box.com, for example, in the US, okay? Now, the interesting thing there is, okay, all you need is three workers to die of heat stroke in a not very well air-conditioned German Amazon warehouse, and you'll get the whole of Germany. They're good at this kind of thing, not yeah. always fairly, but they're very good at kind of self-righteous boycotts, essentially refusing to shop on Amazon for a few weeks. Okay? Is it worth taking that risk just so people can, against their own will to some extent, you know, spend 5 cents less on a copy of some book?
It seems crazy to me because, I mean, you're right. It's probably a rounding error. And you've got the guy who's in charge of it worth $167 billion, although now his wife's worth whatever, et cetera, yeah. and that's all split up. But it boggles my mind that there are so many billions sitting out there and Amazon creates, you know, a colossal amount of money in it every day that they couldn't just be known for paying their workers really well. I think Salesforce is known for that kind of thing. And therefore, there's this halo effect where I don't even really know what Salesforce does particularly, but I know I like them as a company. And the same thing here is Uber and Lyft, because I know Uber is a pretty terrible company, treats their workers much worse, and Lyft does a lot of nice things and treats their drivers in a much better way. So I admit, we're in LA and it's a bubble, and I'm particularly interested in the ethical side of things. But yeah, you're right. Those things wouldn't cost very much and would surely have a knock-on benefit that would be financial.
I mean, you'd think that the whole point of, you know, just as with mass production, the whole point of making things digital is the amount of labor required is less, okay? Ergo, you can treat the labor better. I mean, that was pretty much the idea of the early kind of Quaker philanthropists, certainly. And the fact that it's so inequitable, the distribution of the gains in this way, is very, very strange indeed. Because I don't even think it's good business, in fact. I think it, again, comes from a choice architecture question. Think about it, okay. If you wanted to hire people for a new warehouse and you're going to pay the minimum wage, that would get approved in a board meeting in about 3.5 seconds.
Yeah.
If you said we want to pay above market rates, for which, by the way, there are very, very good arguments. If you're a labor economist, there's a thing called efficiency wages, where you actually deliberately pay a bit more because people stay for longer and they get more expert. You have fewer recruitment costs, you have fewer training costs. The level of commitment that you can draw on from those people, generally, the best employee is someone who thinks they're paid a little bit more than they're worth, okay?
Yeah.
And there are lots and lots of ways in which that actually rewards you. But the argument is a more complicated argument, particularly if you're arguing to people brought up on kind of neoliberal economic doctrine, i.e. Americans.
Yeah.
Okay? And it does seem to me, you know, worrying that I think if you look at the figures, when you raise the minimum wage, there doesn't appear to be any fall off in employment. Now, what that suggests is that people are actually paid less than they should be for reasons other than economic efficiency.
Yeah, I mean, I think it all comes down to that terrible phrase of fiduciary responsibility to our shareholders, whereby you go, look, we've got to, if there's anywhere we can minimize costs, we will minimize costs because we have shareholders. And, you know, whether they happen to be an old folks home that's invested into some sort of investment scheme, or it's just a single person, they always have that excuse. And there's this whole thing about, and you're right, the neoliberalist angle of minimizing all costs at all costs is where things go. So you're right. You can easily make the case to say.
So I always remark this. I'm not sure that America wouldn't be richer if you had 4 weeks vacation instead of two.
Yeah, and it makes.
And there are lots of reasons. You might be more productive. Certainly, patterns of spending would change into more labor-intensive forms of consumption if you had more leisure. Okay, more money would be spent locally, I suspect. Because you're buying fewer Chinese-made goods and spending more on sort of staying in a hotel. It's perfectly possible that there would actually be an economic gain from 4 weeks vacation. But the current doctrine doesn't allow anyone even to consider it. Because wealth generated has to be proportionate to hours worked.
Well, it's not just that. It's the kind of the Protestant work ethic. that work is good in all forms. If anything bad is happening, more work will get you out of that bad situation. If you're failing in any way, work harder and that failing will end. If you can't pay for this, work more, work harder, get another job. And that is the mentality here. That's the interesting flip side to the American dream. The American dream says if you work hard, you can achieve anything. The flip side of that is if you haven't achieved something, it's because you didn't work hard. So Americans live under this weird cloud.
So it is genuinely your, I mean, if you think about it, one of the weirdest differences between British English and American English is the use of the word loser. You remember Donald Trump described the mayor of London as a stone cold loser, which he kind of is a bit. I mean, I'm accent, Sadiq Khan, to be absolutely honest. But loser in British English has almost an affectionate connotation. Which is, you'll love my mate Dave. He's a bit of a loser, but he's a great guy. Okay. Which sort of means that he has been at some level the victim of misfortune. It's probably a bit his fault, but, you know, he's just, you know, unlucky Dave kind of thing. Whereas in the United States, it doesn't really mean you've lost through misfortune. It means you're essentially have failed through your own personal weakness.
And it's an endemic part of your personality. You are a loser.
You are a loser, which is an extraordinary thing. I mean, it isn't really heavily used in the US, as in the UK, as an insult, really. You're absolutely right that the extraordinary Protestant idea that you are the author of your own success, which is to some degree true. I mean, no one's disputing that entirely. But, I mean, Robert Frank, another book I'll recommend to your readers, Robert H. Frank, he's an American at Cornell. He's written this book called Success and Luck. And he makes the point that actually the role that luck plays in anybody's fortune, particularly, I think, disproportionate fortune, okay? I think it's fair to make that distinction. I think that the sort of capitalist world is vaguely meritocratic around the middle. But at the bottom 20% and the bottom 10% and the top 10%, actually, any kind of what you might call effort-reward connection really breaks down at the two extremes. Just to give a very simple example, Steve Jobs, no one for a second is although you can raise the ethical question about Apple, be intrigued to know whether you're an Apple buyer or not.
I am. We can talk about Apple is the least problematic of those. I worked for it directly for 6 years, and all my devices are Apple, and it's very hard to extricate. But as a longer answer to that, I don't have as many ethical problems with what Apple does generally.
Now, the interesting thing there though is that. What I think may happen is that these companies really do need to be slightly frightened by the threat of government intervention at this point, because it is a case where the extraordinary power, actually it's a very strange thing, because the West Coast is both very, very liberal in terms of its social values for the most part, but weirdly indulgent, I think. And weirdly kind of libertarian in terms of its attitude to business, isn't it?
Yeah, I think that's another American thing, though. The incredible psychological trick or whatever that happened whereby poor Americans don't want to regulate rich Americans because at some point they might become rich Americans blows my mind. I mean, the idea that just someone scraping away on minimum wage doesn't want to regulate multimillionaires and billionaires because they might one day become one is mind-boggling to me.
In a weird way, of course, it's one of those things which is, I think, the sense of optimism in the US, which the sense that everything is capable of unlimited improvement, is hugely beneficial in some respects, in that it creates a very innovative consumer economy. One of the things I noticed about American consumers is they effectively, because they believe that life is capable of continual improvement, they are very, very ready to adopt new things. And that, by the way, has an economic value which isn't often quantified. Just, you know, if you contrast it with France, where, you know, if you tried to introduce a new kind of breakfast food in France, you'd be up against essentially, you know, 90% of the population are Platonists who go, if it isn't a croissant, a pot of jam, you know, you're a sexual deviant and a weirdo, you know. So you're up against certain forms of extreme conservatism in a lot of markets. And the US doesn't have that. And the feeling that you can continually improve your lot undoubtedly has benefits at the collective level, but I think it brings costs at the individual level.
Yeah, and I think there's also an element whereby you may have consumer freedom in that way, but actually in creating companies, and this goes down to these particularly tech companies being enormous now, if you're about to come up with a company idea, the question for all investors is, could Amazon do it? Could Facebook do it? Could Google do it? And if the answer is yes, then we're not going to invest.
They won't invest.
And it means that there's been a huge reduction in new companies being created over the last 10 or 20 years. And that's not good for, you know, having the range that would give people, you know, a bit more freedom in terms of what they create and then what they buy. You know, competition is very important. And there's a lot of talk now about breaking up big tech because, you know, Facebook owning Instagram and WhatsApp and all the other things, it creates this sort of bottleneck at the top with one CEO and there's less competition. And what you can't have is, say, Google that owns YouTube is, you know, has its own advertising model and it kind of hamstrings what YouTube's model is. Whereas if YouTube went, we are going to make sure everything on YouTube appears in the right way, not next to dodgy, weird videos and blah, 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 and we can become the beacon of that ethical thing. They can't really do that at the moment because of the connection to Google.
Well, and therefore, because DoubleClick uses both, does it? Is that right?
Well, I think it's not so much that there's a connection.
Oh, but it would make Google look bad.
Well, yeah, there is that, but then there's no competition. So if what you have is an improvement in, and it's not just about ethics, but it's about, you know, we know that people go down rabbit holes on YouTube because YouTube is there to maximize, you know, whether it's Alphabet's money or whatever it happens to be. So they don't really have an incentive to change that or do anything about it. But because there's no competition in these areas, you know, YouTube and Google in terms of search and things like that, they're not really competing with each other. It means that there isn't so much of a freedom of, you know, what these things could do to innovate, to get more customers or to improve the service that they give.
No, I think that's interesting. I mean, one of the interesting debates is there's an interesting paper by a friend of mine, an Australian economist called Nicholas Gruen, called Government as Impresario. And arguably, whereas government, you know, that he thinks that government should be providing certain digital services at a platform level, like, for example, micropayments.
Mm.
And so, you know, an example might be if the government in the UK had said, okay, there's a market failure around micropayments, we're going to create a central micropayment vehicle, okay, then the funding of content might have been much, much easier, which wouldn't have required everything to become dependent on advertising. I also would have legislated, I think the practice of being able to target Telegraph readers when they're not reading the Daily Telegraph is actually thieving. It is thieving from the media, the content provider.
Yeah.
The point I'm making is that the value of the Telegraph and its overall content is in its convening power. It can attract a large and reasonably homogeneous audience of tolerably valuable advertisers in one place, and in that place, people then may buy the right to communicate to them alongside the Telegraph. When you can simply have someone serving a cookie going, I want to reach a Telegraph reader, but I won't pay any money to the Telegraph. I'll just pay some money to Google to reach a Telegraph reader while he's on Pornhub.
Yeah.
Probably unlikely. Not that Telegraph readers don't use Pornhub, but I just mean that's probably not what you choose. But that strikes me as essentially an act of thievery.
That's a very interesting perspective, yeah. I mean, and I think that programmatic advertising is that thing. And if you read Bob Hoffman, Ad Contrarian, he'll give you an enormous amount of information about how the Wild West element of programmatic advertising has huge problems. But that element of it being thievery, I think, is really interesting. You know, they built up that audience. Now it's going to be accessed elsewhere.
They built up the audience, and it's the ability to, for example, okay, let me give you a very simple example. I would, in the 1990s, I think it might have been early 2000s, there was a Bent Copper who would basically sell you the home addresses of people whose cars were seen parked outside casinos, okay? And then other casinos would spot who was attending the other casino and was able then to send them really generous gambling offers to lure them away from that casino to their casino, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Now, I think all of us, without necessarily knowing why, apart from the abuse of data there, would argue that that was an unacceptable practice. In other words, doing something of that kind is not acceptable. Now, if you're an absolutely purist capitalist, you would say, no, it's absolutely fine because the people are getting a better deal.
Or Dave Trott would call it predatory thinking.
and it is highly predatory. I'd argue that the problem with it is that it probably violates Kant's categorical imperative in that if everybody does it, where do you end up? You just end up in a worse place than before. And essentially, you end up in a race to the bottom.
Yeah.
And mechanisms that prevent the race to the bottom strike me as fairly useful. I think the fact that the whole internet space, there hadn't been any attempt to create sort of what you might call common infrastructure over certain things. So, for example, e-commerce would actually be much more competitive and better for the consumer if you had, for example, a universal rating system, a universal payment system, and an accepted mode of delivery, which was under the control of the customer, not the control of the sender, by the way. And one of the things I think Amazon gets hopelessly wrong is it doesn't allow you to choose how your goods are delivered.
Do you mean in terms of time or in...
No. Well, it sometimes gives you some choice about 3 day or 1 day. If I order a USB cable, okay, I want you to put it in the post with Royal Mail. I'll pay £1 for this happily, okay? I don't want some fucking van driving up my drive with a USB cable on it. It's not very zen. The postman comes to my house anyway, yeah. Okay? If I order 5 different USB cables, my house turns into a bloody distribution hub. I'm paying for the sodding postage, so I should decide who delivers it, okay? Not some guy in logistics who's optimized around cost saving.
But they would say you don't, you know, that's reducing your convenience. And these things come down to basically money and convenience. And what Amazon is doing is going click, click, click.
It's not arrives. Really convenience. My postman knows where I live. Okay, he knows exactly what to do if I'm out on the unlikely event that a USB cable. Well, actually, with Amazon packaging, the USB cable probably won't go through my letterbox because they've put in a box the size of the fucking Hindenburg hangar. But we'll park that for a second. Okay. In ordering something to be delivered, I have a load of information which they don't know, okay? Like, well, I'm going to be in the morning, but I'm going to be out in the afternoon. The postman tends to come around about 11 o'clock. Therefore, if I order it by Royal Mail, I'll be in when the postman comes. If I order it by Amazon and they say next day, but next day means up until 9 o'clock in the evening, totally different rules apply. And the fact that they don't let me pay to choose different forms of delivery.
Yeah, I wasn't referring to the convenience of arranging your life around when the delivery happens. But I think people just want to go on and go USB cable, click, it arrives tomorrow, click, click, click. And but then if you give people 7 choices of a delivery method, etc., then you're adding this. And I don't understand it because I think that people have become so used to this mindless convenience that, you know, there are compromises that happen. And the one you're talking about just there as an example is one of them. But people are just like, no, I'm happy for Amazon to stick a box somewhere on my porch or whatever, and that's all okay. But the weird thing is boycotting Amazon, as I do, isn't really that much of a problem. There are other places you can buy these things. The prices aren't that much more. The delivery is fine. It takes maybe a little bit longer to put your address into things, but because of the autofill on Safari, it's not really
exactly,
that much
yes.
a problem.
Yeah, that's not a big deal. Interestingly, the other thing I don't understand about Amazon is that ultimately, in order to make this whole system work, you've got to actually develop click and collect. Okay?
Yeah.
Now, Amazon could easily nudge collection so that the majority of people actually had it delivered to a nearby locker and collected it, right?
Yeah.
Which would inordinately reduce the environmental cost and the financial cost of delivery to the door.
Yeah.
Particularly if you take a country like the UK, which is sodding tiny, you know, there are 60 millionaires crammed in this place. If you think about it, you've got nationwide coverage in the UK. I think there are about 1,000 BP stations. There are about 1,000 Shell stations, okay? So you only need about 4,000 places, and you've got essentially not quite walking distance coverage outside London, but easy driving distance coverage for pretty much the whole population. Most people leave the house once a day, and they go somewhere with a higher population density. On the way, they could pick up the shed, yeah. Okay? I don't understand why so little effort is made to actually nudge that as an alternative, given that it would save them a fortune.
Well, I think there's also benefits that we don't really realize or that are hard to quantify of leaving your house and going to a shop or seeing some other people or seeing
No, of course. And also because also there, you know, you can drop off your dry cleaning, you know, you can combine it with four or five other things. And actually, Amazon has a problem because it's a very good way for 10 people to buy one thing, but it's not a very good way for one person to buy 10 things. If you actually order 10 things on Amazon, given that they don't all arrive simultaneously, although you have Amazon Day, don't you, in the US? We don't have that here yet.
What is Amazon Day?
It's where apparently you have a kind of day where Amazon come, and everything you order is then essentially consolidated into a single delivery on that day.
Oh, okay.
It's a way of, I think, stopping this problem where you order five things, and then they arrive in three different shipments.
Right.
But, I mean, there's something there that strikes me as very weird, that they make it very difficult for me to choose a locker and very easy for me to choose home delivery.
Yeah, and do you know how they do think they're testing this out? I don't know how much it's spread, but I worked on something a couple of years ago when I was freelancing that they, on university campuses, have like an Amazon shop which has 25 lockers in it, and you can order most of the things that university people want, whether it's a USB cable or a pack of Pringles.
To the locker.
And I don't know if they have behind the locker a sort of little mini warehouse of essentially 500 products, and they put them in the locker. So you can collect it literally 10 seconds after you've, ordered it.
Ah, gotcha.
They're doing that. And then they also have these, I mean, them going back into brick and mortar is quite fascinating as well, whereby you're registered so you can just literally pick things up in shop and then walk out with them because they know who you are and they can track all that. So
they're starting to do that business where you just walk into the shop and walk straight out.
Yeah, and people are queuing up to do it. They're like, oh my God, this is incredible. And I guess in some ways it is the future, but Amazon crushing the bricks and mortar retail sector only to build it up again, which is essentially what Starbucks did. Let's put five Starbucks on the same street. All the coffee shops now die. Then we close down three of the Starbucks, and that's how things are going to be, is a sort of version of what Amazon is now going to be doing. So, It just seems to be a sort of deliberate, not cruelty, but I mean, they have such power that they can do stuff like this. And, you know.
And you find exercising consumer boycotts in the US surprisingly difficult to you?
Well, I don't know. I mean, nearly every conversation I have about Amazon where I explain, you know, anything that's problematic about it, people are stunned. They're like, what's wrong with Amazon? And I go, well, here's a few things. So I realize it's a sort of, it's a gnat bite on the side of an elephant and doesn't really make a lot of difference. So I just think people aren't really that attuned to doing it at the moment. There are more demonstrations and people doing it, but it doesn't seem to necessarily affect corporate behavior. But I don't know. Maybe things will grow in that direction.
But the B Corporation is a really important concept. I mean, that's a very useful concept, which is that the kind of Milton Friedman idea that a company, John Kay's written very well on this. If you read his book, Obliquity.
Right.
His argument is that the companies that most narrowly pursue profit are not, in the medium to long term, the most profitable. The most profitable corporate strategy is to pursue some oblique end and to measure it through your profitability.
Yeah, all the things we've talked about in terms of say, staffing and you know, that whole thing about Henry Ford paying his workers more money so they could buy his cars. I know that feels like a more cynical kind of attitude towards it, but it's like when I read about universal basic income and people being interested in that, and they're going, we'll give everyone 20 grand. And I go, well, if you, Apple, want to support that, no one's ever going to be able to buy one of your iPhones or laptops ever. So how do you think, without managing to finance people's spending power with wages, are they going to be able to purchase your goods?
It's very interesting. I mean, universal basic income is interesting because, to me, it's always fascinated me. I don't think it works, being absolutely candid. I'm not sure you can make it work. Most economic people seem to think that, or at least you'd have to get rid of a remarkable number of welfare programs to fund it.
Yeah.
To a way with, I suppose what you'd do is you'd still have welfare funds for what you might call inarguable cases of suffering. But the government would get out of the misfortune business and focus simply on what you might call extreme, you know, disability and, you know, mental illness and so forth.
Yeah.
Now, the interesting thing with universal basic income to me is the fact that people on the right quite like it as well as people on the left. Nixon liked it, for example.
Yeah.
It's an idea. And it may be that what they like about it is that although people on the right think they oppose redistribution of wealth, I think what they really instinctively dislike about it is the fact that it distorts basic incentives. Now, what they may like about universal basic income is if you work 20 hours more than the guy next door to you, you are proportionately richer than him, even though you both receive $20,000 a year as basic income. And the problem you'll face is that really clever people will game the system by forming communes and moving to very, very low property cost areas, where actually five people pooling $100,000 a year could probably live really rather well.
Yeah, I mean, I'd be fascinated.
I would argue if that's what they want to do, well, fine.
Yeah.
But you might argue that the fact of people gaming the system would become so annoying to hardworking taxpayers.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a tricky one in terms of
it's a bit of a gift to stoners, isn't it? I mean, you know, you move into a really low, you know, you move into a really, really low property cost area somewhere in the US, and essentially, you know, you've got $100,000, you know, $20,000 probably keeps you just about fed.
Yeah.
You know, just about keeps the household running, and then the rest of the money can be spent essentially on high quality weed. I mean, that is a bit of a danger.
I do imagine there are quite a lot of people living in that manner right now, already. Somehow. But
yeah, that's probably fair.
Whether
yeah.
off welfare or not. The widest question I wanted to ask you about in terms of counterintuitive thinking and behavior is climate change. Because we have this thing which is a sort of existential threat, looks very much like it's on the horizon, backed up by 99% of scientists, and yet there's a colossal amount of effort moving in the other direction and also getting people to behave in a way that might in any way mitigate these terrible effects which might end up with us living in a terrible dystopian society in the somewhat near future. Do you have an opinion about how and why we're reacting in this way?
It's complicated. I think there have been mistakes made, which is, I don't know the answer to this question, but would electric cars and hybrids now be more popular had they not been sold on an environmental platform?
It's an interesting question.
Simply sold on their selfish merits.
Well, my theory as a Tesla driver is that what Elon Musk did was he looked at every reason why someone wouldn't buy an electric car and crossed it off by going, is it comfortable? Is it fast? Is it prestigious-y? Is it whatever?
Well, the interesting thing is that the interesting question about it is that on sheer selfish performance terms and price terms, the electric car wins, right?
Yeah.
The only question is one of range, I guess, which, of course, with a Tesla with the super fast charging stations. Do you ever have a range problem? Because the weird obstacle in the UK seems to be range anxiety, which is completely stupid because the UK is tiny, okay? I mean, genuinely, there are people, I mean, patently professional limo drivers who, you know, I've got a driver who does 70,000 miles a year, okay? Ain't going to work for him for a while. I accept that, all right?
Yeah.
But for most normal motorists, for 99.5% of their journeys, an electric car would be just fine.
Absolutely. Okay. I mean, and I did drive across America and back via the supercharger route, so for free, essentially, a few years ago, which was great. But yeah, the day-to-day, it makes no difference at all. There are just some times when you want to go somewhere and the supercharger network doesn't 100% cover it, but I can't think of that situation that's happened in the 4 years since I've owned one.
Why haven't they found a market solution to that, whereby pubs, or whatever the American equivalent of pub is, but places with car parks can make money installing superchargers.
Well, they
and that's how gas stations got started, right? Because you could make money selling gas, so people did. So why isn't there? I mean, there. No one has tried. We live in a. It's not a commune, but it's several house. It's two blocks of apartments in a grade one Robert Adam house, and then a modern block, and then two separate houses. So there are 17 households, about 50 people living there. Okay. I said, okay, look, there are 50 of us living here. We need to start installing some electric charging points, guys, because for most of us here, our next car will be an electric car. Now, that should be the easiest thing in the world for me to install three, at least 7 kilowatt chargers, okay? Now, I'm not sure how on earth you install a 100 kilowatt charger, what sort of weird access to the grid you need to do that. But certainly 7 kilowatt chargers, which are kind of overnight capable. Yeah. For a reasonable car. Okay, yeah, it's not easy for me to do that. Now, if you just, you know, if you just provided me with an incentive of any kind to get one of these things installed, there is a government incentive, but you've got to already own an electric car to qualify. Well, I said, you total fucking morons, that's catch 22. If you sell me the charging point, I'll buy the car. I'm not going to install an electric charging point and then go and buy a diesel, am I? I'd feel like a total dick, right?
Yeah.
But the behavioral science understanding of the people who design these incentive programs is so fucking bad, and their understanding of path dependency and catch 22 is so feeble. They've put a £4,000 incentive to buy an electric car and only a £300 incentive to install a charger. Now, I don't know why Brits are so frightened of range anxiety, because, as I said, the country's tiny. Also, of course, what they don't understand is that the navigation technology will basically tell you what to do anyway, won't it? So when you start running low, what does it do?
Yeah, it tells you where the nearest...
Stop here. And it knows whether it's free or used, does it?
Well, I mean, there's a difference between go back to your pub question. There's a difference between the supercharger network, which is obviously they're very fast chargers that are sponsored by Tesla that are generally do take up parking spaces in places where you can go and get something to eat or go to the loo or whatever it happens to be. But there are also other chargers all over the country, whether it's owned by people or whatever, where there's a network where you can charge in. But yeah, if you set your destination on the nav, it'll tell you if you're too far away from the next supercharger to be able to get there in time or get back to where you want to get to. So, but that's just kind of based on the supercharger network rather than every charger.
Wider charger network, I'm not sure.
But you should be able to. It's just that you might end up having to wait a bit longer to charge your car at a non-supercharger, which I think for a lot of people is a little bit more annoying around, because it could be a charger that's going to take you 4 hours to get you going again than 25 minutes.
They solved this in the 18th century, of course, in England, which is that taverns were also where you changed your horses, also doubled as places you could drink alcohol and possibly as brothels. So you were kept occupied for the period of the duration of the wait.
I feel like Tesla should add these two elements to their superchargers.
The coaching in needs to make a return, doesn't it?
Yeah, there aren't enough brothels at superchargers at all.
No. There's a whole business opportunity there, you see.
Yeah.
It's an interesting question. So 4 hours is a bit painful. 2 hours isn't, really. Because you can generally occupy yourself for 2 hours fairly easily.
Yeah, and you know, if you time it, there are stops you need to make to eat and go to the loo anyway.
Exactly,
so.
Yeah. So Nassim Taylor was telling me he drove from New York to Atlanta and there was no inconvenience because you'd simply charge when you're having lunch.
Yeah, that's what we did when we went across the country.
And you wouldn't drive from New York to Atlanta without stopping for a few hours anyway, would you?
No.
One overnight stop and one lunchtime stop is going to be fairly much standard.
And after you've been sitting in a car for two hours plus, you kind of get a bit of...
Yeah, things are changed. I know, I completely agree, yeah. Yeah.
And stretch your legs.
And then what do you charge at home? You charge it with a sort of 7 kilowatt thing, do you?
I have a Tesla charger. So when you buy a Tesla, I think it was like $800. You have a Tesla charger, which actually charges faster than most chargers. But it's an overnight thing, and you can set it to do it when the electricity is cheapest.
Ah, gotcha. Oh, interesting. No, so I mean, the obstacle in Britain, what interests me is it's not economic, it's psychological. And this is why the behavioral science practice is so important, because there are so many things which people don't do, not for economic reasons. In other words, it's not about, it's about irrational fears, it's about misunderstanding, lack of comprehension. And I think, to be honest, the fact that they've been sold as an environmental product degrades it a bit, because people then assume that if it's good for the environment, it must involve some degree of hair-shirted personal sacrifice.
Yeah,
when in fact, actually, the reasons to do it, selfish reasons to do it, are perfectly good enough on their own. I mean, why use up people's store of altruism getting to do something which they would do if they were merely selfish?
Well, I think that's the case here, because when the Model S came out, you know, it was somewhere between 70 to 100 and something thousand dollars. So I don't think you ever felt like the hair shirt situation was going on. I think you felt like you were doing a good thing, but to drive an incredibly prestigious, like Mercedes level car anyway.
It's an interesting question whether, given the lifespan of these things, whether he should have bothered producing a cheap version anyway. Because the lifespan is so hard, so long. You need to replace the battery, but actually the number of moving parts is trivial, right?
It is. So the maintenance is virtually non-existent. And I think there must be a big secondhand market in it now. And I think if you wanted to buy a brand new Model 3 at maybe 35 to 40 grand, depending on the extras, or...
Why wouldn't you buy a three-year-old Model S?
I think you'd buy it would make much more sense to buy a three-year-old Model S.
Now, interesting, if you think about it, that's what Apple does, because Apple has been bullied by the city to produce the 5C, you know, the cheaper plasticky version, which was cheaper because the claim was you can't capture enough of the developing world, blah, 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 at your current price point. But of course, humans have solved that problem already by effectively, you buy an older version of the top of the range phone. You don't buy an overtly lower range product. Fine. There's a huge second-hand market, which is this is a terrible thing, but let's be honest, okay? How many blokes have probably bought the Apple, the iPhone X, and given their old iPhone to their wife, daughter, son? Do you see what I mean?
Well, we have. In my family, there's a sort of hand-me-down situation where I don't know if it goes from me or my wife. That's a more contentious situation. But when the kids eventually want or need a smartphone, they'll get our old ones, and we'll buy something new.
Yeah, and so exactly that, which I think is exactly how it works. And also, of course, it's much less of a status. It's much more of a status sacrifice by owning a product which is known to be a mid to bottom range product than it is to own the older version of a top of the range thing.
Well, I think there's also an element
that, you know, you might have bought the iPhone 8 when it was new and just be the kind of person who holds onto their iPhone for a long time. It doesn't suggest you're actually impoverished.
No, and I think there's also this element whereby the incremental improvements in recent iPhones have been, and not just iPhones, but in phones in general, have been so small that it's not really, I mean, it's almost like, why do you want the new one? And facial recognition possibly isn't really, when they added a video camera to the 3GS or the 4S or whatever it was, that was worth getting. And then
that's a big deal. Yeah.
And I think now the improvements aren't so much that you go, oh my God, we've all got to get the next new one because there's something amazing about it. That hasn't happened for a while.
And quite a few of the improvements are software improvements anyway, aren't they?
Yeah,
so actually get those anyway.
Well, the amount of times we had to say it's now the dual core processor that's 7 times faster, and I'm going, how slow is my current iPhone? It seems to be, I mean, how much faster is the thing going to get? And the Retina screen is beyond the human eye's ability to tell how good it is.
They can't make
the screen any better. So it just seems
you're at the limits of psychophysics in many of these things, aren't you? And unless you want software to be insanely bloaty, then actually, I mean, it's a very interesting question, of course, with Apple, which is what they do next. And it comes down to how you define yourself as a company. You know, it's bizarre they haven't got into an industry like banking or finance. But there's an argument that I suppose it's rich enough for you not to suspect they're actually... I mean, it's all about reputational skin in the game, isn't it? Their ability to charge what they do for their phones, which is their core business... would be irreparably dented if they started doing something really dodgy. Whereas, of course, with Facebook, you're the product.
Yeah, and there's also an
Apple.
Sorry, go on.
Apple, Amazon's a bit complicated because Amazon doesn't actually make any money, so it's not entirely clear what the product is. Is data the product?
Well, apparently it's Amazon Web Services is the giant...
Amazon Web Services makes money on the back of it, doesn't it? That is actually a highly lucrative business.
Yeah.
But the actual retail thing doesn't actually make money, which is kind of weird.
This is what I don't quite understand. Like Uber, loses money, Lyft loses money, Slack loses money, Amazon doesn't make a profit. But and yet there are all these people behind these companies with absolutely billions of dollars. Someone's making money.
Why doesn't Argos just claim it's a digital company? Because if Argos were a digital company, it would be worth billions because it's the first really successful multi-channel retailer, okay?
Mm-hmm.
It's got a network. It's got a fantastic network of bricks and mortar locations. It does every form of commerce you could possibly want. And yet, for some reason, people expect Argos to make a lot of money.
Yeah.
Whereas Amazon, they don't. Now, you know, I always jokingly say that Amazon has spent $500 billion effectively discovering that Argos was right all along. And that actually people want multi-channel retail. They want to be able to buy from one place, collect from another, you know, return to a third place. You know, essentially, Argos got it right, albeit accidentally. And the fact that Argos is expected to make growing profits and return value to its shareholders, whereas Amazon isn't, is kind of weird.
But it feels like they set this up in such a way that they were never going to be beholden to the needs of Wall Street. Because once you have to start playing that game, you need to start, you know, you drop one quarter and you're screwed and your share price is plummeted and all this sort of stuff. If you don't even play that game, which Amazon seems to, you know, have decided not to participate in the way that most other companies have to. I don't know how they did it, but it seems like no one cares.
My theory is that the valuation of Amazon depends on an assumption of the growth of e-commerce, which my knowledge of human psychology suggests won't come true. So in other words, if you notice, I think what we'll start to see, this is my prediction, so what I'm saying is falsifiable, okay, that the volume of e-commerce through Amazon at Christmas time will start to level off. And the reason is that at Christmas time, people reach what you might call peak e-commerce, which is the most shit you can manage to have in cyberspace at any one time before you mentally start to decompose or because you're driven mad. Because if you think about it, okay, all it takes effectively is for one of your Christmas deliveries to go wrong and all your time savings are essentially wiped out.
Yeah.
And I think there's a volume at which people, I think there's a natural equilibrium which will be reached between physical commerce and e-commerce. And I think it will end up with e-commerce being lower than the than the analysts predict or assume. Because analysts have been wrong about things like quad play. You know, they assume that the person who offers all these four things in one package, by dint of being slightly cheaper, will therefore win the whole market. Actually, consumers treat quad play like a shit sandwich. They don't want it.
Yeah, and I think the perception of economies of scale on Amazon is really what helps it enormously, because you go, this thing is big, therefore big things always, their savings involve somewhere, and therefore I'm going to make their savings. But I think Amazon...
Which is, by the way, only sometimes true. Let me have a look here, okay. So this will be quite interesting. Right, here, let me see if they sell it. Okay, so the old name Muso, Wireless Music System, okay? They've introduced a new one at £1,400. So the old one, which is a huge, great, fantastic name speaker with its own DAC and its own wireless capability and radio and everything else, okay? Amazon's selling it for £799, okay? Now, my local branch of Seven Oaks Sound and Vision is selling them for £599.
Mm. Yeah, I think it's a perception thing rather than a real thing.
I think the whole thing rests on the perception that scale and volume necessarily brings you value, which I don't think is actually a safe assumption.
No, but it's a universal, if not universal, then massive assumption that most people do think. And that's why, you know, you go to Costco or whatever. And I know Costco is built on the financial model, but you do go, well, you know, they're selling kajillions of these things and therefore economies of scale must mean they're cheaper than if I go around my corner shop.
But of course, we are educated to believe that by the insurance industry, which always went about cut out the middleman.
Yeah.
And it's not a totally safe assumption, I have to say. You know, it strikes me as it's sometimes true, but in many cases, I mean, it's also true in media buying. It's not necessarily true that the biggest buyer of media gets the best deals, simply because if you've got a really good deal, you don't tell the biggest media buyer.
No, absolutely. Yeah.
So it was always the case that when we, you know, small media buying shops get offered bargains which the larger ones don't.
Yeah. I think it's much more complicated in reality. It's funny because there are so many other choices of retailer here. I don't know if you're aware of the phenomenon of Bed Bath & Beyond and its 20% off voucher.
Yes, of course, yes, very much, yeah.
So we get that regularly through the post. And even if you don't get it, you get emails with vouchers as well. And once you've looked at the price of Bed Bath & Beyond, it's often substantially cheaper than Amazon. But, you know, this is a matter of what we used to be happy to do in the past, which was shop around a little bit, you know, to make a savings. Now I think people are just like, click, 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 I don't want to bother. And, you know, they don't make that effort.
No, and of course the assumption is that Amazon will be at least competitive, which is mostly true. It's a very interesting question. I mean, the only thing is that so much business decision making is based on the assumptions of neoliberal economic theory, and you know, a very large part of Amazon's sort of probably a large part of Amazon's competitive advantage is that because it has the largest range, you go there first. Okay. You go there first, you find something that's acceptable, you buy it.
Yeah.
On the assumption that if it isn't available at Amazon, it won't be available anywhere else. Now, obviously, there are categories where Amazon fails where that isn't true, fashion being a classic case. Okay. If you're buying high fashion, you don't go to Amazon because most of the brands won't be dealing with them.
No.
And probably that's true of high-end hi-fi as well, I guess, that the high-end hi-fi manufacturers are probably holding off. There are certain categories of places where they are actually going to be, you know, limiting what they offer.
Well, there's also this mid-market element vibe of the things you buy on Amazon. Like, you wouldn't really buy a Rolex on Amazon. I don't think you'd buy Dom Perignon Cristal, even though you probably can. I think there's a retailer coming up at the moment, which is the I feel okay about buying really high-end shit rather than Amazon, which is the mid-market, everyday kind of stuff.
There's certainly scope for someone actually to charge a big premium by doing really super premium delivery, by the way.
Yeah.
Which is that in many cases, you know, the number of – and Amazon Prime has started – I don't know if this has happened in the States. Its promise used to be if you order on Amazon Prime, the Prime things are delivered free the next day.
Yeah.
And that's becoming increasingly less true. So I increasingly fill a basket with Prime things on the assumption that I work from home on a Friday, they'll all arrive on Friday, that'll all be convenient, and then discover that two of them won't arrive until the following Tuesday. Well, that's not really the deal, is it?
Just going back to the environmental thing, and I get from your reply that it is an incredibly complicated thing, and I think people are finding it incredibly complicated. I was just wondering if... the thing you mentioned about Tesla also is if you can get people to do a good thing without realizing they're doing a good thing,
why not just do good by stealth?
Yeah.
Why ask people to turn their supermarket trip into an exercise in bloody competing calls on their altruistic instincts? When I'll give you a very simple example. If you want people to use a concentrated dishwasher powder, okay, two things happen. Okay, it's good because it's a concentrate, so there's generally less packaging and there's generally, you know, less of the transportation costs and so on. Okay. The problem is that when there's less of it, one, people assume it's doing less of a good job because there's less of it. Okay. Two, so their perception of its efficacy falls. Secondly, it looks like bad value for money on the shelf because it's a smaller container, so they're less likely to buy it. Three, they're somewhat prone to overdose because they go, well, this isn't enough, I'll put in a bit more. If, on the other hand, you do what Finish does, which is you sell the quantum tablet, which has a red ball in the middle and two yin and yang things around the outside, which contain different forms of chemical, the human brain automatically thinks that complexity equals efficacy.
Yeah.
So it doesn't notice the fact that you're using less of something or that you're using a specified dose of something because it thinks, like stripy toothpaste, this is complicated, therefore it's good.
Yeah.
Okay. Very simple heuristic. Well, if you want to do concentrates, use that. Put weird coloured flecks in it. Add a degree of difficulty to the use. Even counterintuitively, you can make something seem effective by making it seem a bit of extra work. You know, like a powder, you have to sort of grind up and then dilute or something like that. Okay, use those mental tricks rather than calling on people to don the hair shirt every time they go to the supermarket. And in the case of the Tesla, you know, as he said, there isn't really a reason why the Tesla's worse than a Mercedes diesel, okay? on every objective measure, including running cost, maintenance cost, everything else, it's a better fucking car. My argument is the only reason Teslas aren't more common, more popular, is because people assume that if you make an environmentally friendly decision, it has to involve some degree of sacrifice. In terms of the Tesla, I don't really see where that sacrifice is. I mean, the performance is insane, isn't it?
It is. It's every element about it is. But I think you're absolutely right that the thing in the back of your mind is where is this costing me somehow? And
yeah.
Really, with the Tesla, there isn't. I think that's what Elon Musk probably started with. You know, if you're going to go, where's the catch, or what am I compromising here somewhere? But
no, it's interesting. We naturally the brain looks for trade-offs.
Yeah. If you're getting something,
and if you
here,
look at those great advertising end lines, reassuringly expensive, good things come to those who wait. We're number two, so we try harder. You either love it or you hate it. Fresh cream cakes, naughty but nice. You reel off all those great ad slogans, and they have the little trade-off built in.
Yeah.
And maybe that's what Elon should have done. He should have worked out with a slogan which says, the downside is this, but.
Yeah, and oddly, they don't advertise Tesla, so there was never really a...
Now, is that a mistake? Because that's a really interesting point, because in terms of what the company spends, the cost of advertising would be fairly trivial.
Yeah.
Okay. One of the things that advertising does is it makes something seem... I mean, you know, a smart thing would have been that for the first 20,000 Teslas you sell, they had to be pink so that everybody would notice them and go, God, there are a lot of Teslas around. But... The Tesla, the great thing about advertising is it essentially says to the human heuristic, this must be a mainstream pop product, because if you're using mass media to advertise it, you are clearly expecting to sell to a very large number of people.
So it may be a Model 3 thing rather than a Tesla brand thing, because I think with Model 3, he's trying to get into the area where it is a mass market thing. But...
I always think that Uber made this mistake, that actually they had a perfectly lovely business when Uber was a posh taxi firm, which is how it started, okay?
Yeah.
What is it driving? Which is, if you think about it, okay, if you look at the United States luxury car industry, which in the days of Packard and so forth, was equal to Rolls-Royce, okay? Cadillac and Packard were kind of on a par with Rolls-Royce, right?
Yeah.
And in both cases, they felt they had to produce these mainstream... Now, the French don't do that, do they? You know, you don't get bloody Louis Vuitton producing a diffusion range of baseball caps with Louis Vuitton on, okay? What is it about this American democratization? Now, okay, for mass products like Coke, Americans are fantastic at doing the branding there, okay? You know, they have that fundamental assumption that if something's good, it should be. The French have the opposite assumption. Anything that's any good has to be in short supply, whether it's wine, pâté de foie gras, you know, whatever it is, you know, luxury goods, perfume, anything worth having is only available in scarce supply, okay? Now, Americans do have produced extraordinary luxury brands, Tumi luggage, for example. They, you know, I mean, they've done it in retail. But there's a strange American thing, which is that the instinct to grow, in a sense, is inimical to the ability to charge a really good premium. I always wondered that with Uber. I always thought Uber was a brilliant idea when it basically meant, okay, I need to get to the airport. I can't be bothered to faff around with a load of people speaking a foreign language. If an Uber turns up, it will be a reasonably posh car, which will take me there. It'll be about the same price as a normal cab. Everybody wins. I mean, the Uber Lux does quite well because the drivers typically, they own an £80,000 Mercedes,
okay, yeah,
in London. And typically their money is taking two people to Heathrow, you know, the head of fixed income trading for Deutsche Bank and three other guys like that. They do two or three trips to Heathrow for which they get like 100 and something quid each. And that basically pays for the whole shebang. Now, Uber Lux was great because in between they can do a few 50 quid jobs rather than sitting around reading the paper. So they're better off, the passengers better off, everybody wins. Now, okay, I'm glad Uber expanded because the fact that it's universally and widely available, I think, makes it very valuable. But there is an extent to which this idea of disruption You know, in other words, everyone in Silicon Valley feels they have to disrupt the whole fucking category. Why can't you just find a really nice, profitable niche, operate there, a niche that was underserved in the past, and just get on with making a reasonable amount of money instead of trying to destroy an entire swathe of existing capitalism, which is doing the job perfectly well? You know, I always think, you know, if Silicon Valley, like, invented a new aircraft toilet, right, instead of going, hey, Boeing, you have toilets, would you like to buy our toilet? The approach in Silicon Valley would be, we have to start an entirely new airline around this toilet and design a new aircraft to actually carry this fucking toilet. And you're going, look, actually, there's something there about the obsession with, and I think there's something about the mentality that is deeply disturbing, because the Silicon Valley mentality essentially arises from people. So I'm in Palo Alto, right? No, I'm not. I'm in Menlo Park. I'm in Menlo Park, and there are these little miniature gas tankers driving around full of gasoline. I said to my wife, what the fuck is that? And they said, oh, no, it's like Uber for gasoline. While you're at work coding, they go around to your car and they fill it up with petrol. What the fuck do you want that for? I mean, genuinely. Okay, it's not that often I have to fill up with petrol. When I do, I nearly always buy a pint of milk and a pork pie and a couple of packets of crisps and a newspaper. Okay, it's not like I stop for petrol. It's not like I'm standing there at the petrol pump going, oh, God, this is just such a waste of my time. If only I were coding, right? Okay, now, if you have genuinely a bunch of people who see life as a time efficiency optimization challenge, okay, at some level, that's philosophically just a bit sick. You see what I mean? In other words, everything is the what you might call... I mean, Adam Smith spotted this, that the division of labor in some ways is a wonderful thing for productivity, but it's actually a slightly diminishing thing for the nature of human work, because it involves less variety.
Well, and also, yeah, in all the labor-saving and time-saving devices we've created over the last 50, 60 years,
we haven't saved much time.
No one's working any less. It's crazy. So
this total failure. Now, interestingly, I mean, I think what we can do with video conferencing and such like is we can one of the things we have to do is change the pattern of business, at least change the pattern and rhythm of the business week slightly. So, you know, days are going to be longer because you're going to have more conversations with people in different time zones. Arguably, what you may need is something like a 4-day week of 9-hour days, of which, or 10-hour days, of which you spend 4 hours at home, or something like that. I don't know how it's going to work. And then you work from home on a Friday or whatever.
Yeah.
But that's a coordination problem. And unless we solve that coordination problem, we solve it collectively, then the internet will have actually brought only about sort of 50% of the potential quality of life benefits that it's capable of. Because if we're still getting up in the morning, we're all traveling to work simultaneously on crowded highways. And in LA, you need no reminding of that.
Mm-hmm.
Because we're all going to the office at exactly the same time and we're working the same hours as everybody else. And we don't separate our week in terms of what's physical and face-to-face and what's virtual. If we don't do that, a large part of the gains from this technology are basically squandered.
Sure.
And I think that's a really interesting behavioral science challenge. You know, it might involve things like naming things. I mean, to be honest, it's pretty evident that if you go to a suburban railway car park on a Friday now, it's bloody empty. A hell of a lot of people work from home on a Friday. But nobody's made it official and passed down permission to everybody else. They just kind of do it furtively. And I think at some stage, you know, new patterns of working life have to be created. I mean, it drives me nuts seeing people in the office doing email. What the fuck is the point of traveling into a building to do something which you can do on a beach? It just doesn't make any fucking sense at all.
Absolutely.
Unless the purpose of your job is just to look busy, which is perfectly plausible.
That's a lot of what people do.
There's a big Californian problem, isn't there, with eucalyptus trees were introduced from Australia and their leaves are unbelievably flammable. Is that right?
I hadn't heard that, but that sounds totally plausible. But the one thing we do have here is palm trees aren't indigenous to California. They were all brought in from abroad or elsewhere. And they're all suffering a kind of slow death. Apparently in the next
20 or 30 years, there's something that they have wrong with them that's going to mean that they all decompose and LA's not going to have any anymore. So,
Shit, that'll be terrible.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting that, you know, you see palm trees pretty much everywhere here. And I think it was a really good, it was a really good advertising thing. It was to entice people from the Midwest to come and set up home here. So that worked pretty well.